And it is again my honor to welcome all of you to a Weber training teleclass. My name is Paul Weber, and this teleclass is entitled Travel-Related Infectious Disease. Our faculty today will not be a stranger to many of you. Dr. Bob Wheeler has given three or possibly four teleclasses in the past. Dr. Bob is a great guy and a very good friend, and he happens to be a worldwide authority on travel medicine. A goodly part of his time is spent at sea as a cruise ship physician. In fact, he is currently chairperson of the American College of Emergency Physicians section on cruise ship and maritime medicine. I hope I got all that right. To present travel-related infectious disease, I am pleased to present Dr. Robert Wheeler. Bob.
Thank you, Paul, and good afternoon, everyone. Today we're going to discuss a variety of different types of infectious diseases that you may encounter during your travels. And perhaps even more important, we'll be discussing ways to prevent these infectious diseases from disrupting your journey. Next slide. Though at times frustrating, travel is an exciting activity for many people. In the United States, more than 60 million people travel outside of the United States each year, and more than half of the total population of Canada leave their own country each year. Now, a lot of this is going across each other's border, but about 25% of these travelers end up going to developing countries or tropical countries as well. And when they go there, there are certain things that may bring up some hazards for them, such as tropical infectious diseases, dangerous transportation, hazardous activities, and limited healthcare resources. Next slide. Now, there are certain things about foreign travel that can expose a traveler to potential risks that are dependent upon several different factors. One, obviously, is the destination. Second is the duration of the trip. Usually, the longer you go on a trip, the greater the odds that something is going to happen while you're away from home. Activities have a big effect. If you're staying at a resort area, just sort of lounging around the pool, the odds of you having some type of problem are very different than if you're out hiking in the bush somewhere. Your baseline health status is very important. Very often people go beyond their capabilities when they're on a trip, so it's always important to consider what your baseline health status is. And then, of course, is the preparations for travel, including vaccinations, protection against insect bites, and malaria prophylaxis, which we'll talk about later on. Next slide. Now, one of the most common problems that we encounter during travel is what we call traveler's diarrhea. And up to 60% of people on a two-week trip to certain parts of the world, such as Latin America, Africa, Asia, or the Middle East, will come down with a bout of traveler's diarrhea. And what this is loose watery stools, often accompanied by abdominal cramping or bloating, nausea, fecal urgency, and fever. Typically, it's sudden onset, and it usually lasts for less than a week. However, certain pathogens, such as parasites, which we'll talk about in a few moments, it can become chronic and can extend for several weeks even after you get back home. Next slide. There are several causes or several reasons why people develop traveler's diarrhea. It's typically acquired via ingestion of fecally contaminated food or water. And this includes undercooked meat and seafood, raw fruits and vegetables, dairy products, water, and ice. But one of the other things that can contribute to this is inadequate personal hygiene practices. Very often when you're traveling, you may have a limited availability of washrooms. And so that even though at home you may be very consistent about washing your hands throughout the day, it may not be available when you're traveling. That's why more and more people are taking non-water and alcohol-based hand washes with them. Next slide. There are several risk factors directly associated to developing traveler's diarrhea. I already mentioned the destination factor. Duration of the visit, the longer you stay in a particular location where traveler's diarrhea is endemic, the greater the chances that you may develop diarrhea. After a while, there's a bit of a complacency with prevention measures. You may not be as careful about what food you're eating or how you prepare your water or washing your hands. If you eat from street vendors, you have a greater chance of developing traveler's diarrhea as compared to eating at good restaurants or having home-cooked meals in the location that you're at. And young travelers tend to be a little more risky than the older traveler. As a matter of fact, in the Journal of Travel Medicine this month, there was an interesting study looking at young males in Mexico, and they found that the young males that drank more than 5 beers a day had a greater chance of developing traveler's diarrhea than females who drank as much. And so there are several factors that can determine whether or not you're going to develop traveler's diarrhea. Next slide, number 7. Now, there are several causative agents for traveler's diarrhea. About 85% are due to bacteria, and a vast majority of that is due to enterotoxigenic E. coli, or ETEC. Other bacterial causes include salmonella, very common in eggs and chickens, shigella, campylobacter, ribbio, parahemolyticus, very common in seafood, listeria in dairy products. Next slide. You also have viral agents. My favorite, obviously, is norovirus. This is something that's been in the news quite a bit over the past couple of years, not only for the cruise industry, but for the hotel and resort industry and hospitals all over the world. As a matter of fact, this past week, there's been a large outbreak on a cruise ship up in southeast Alaska, affecting 350 passengers and crew. Rotavirus is a similar virus, more notably found in children. And then you have several parasites that can cause traveler's diarrhea, and those include Giardia. This is something that in certain parts of the United States and Canada, it's endemic in beaver populations. As a matter of fact, here in New England and other parts of the country, it's known as beaver fever. People go out camping and they find what appears to be a clear brook and they drink out of this. Well, upstream, you have the beavers who have their dens and their excrement, and it contaminates the water. Other types of parasites include entamoeba, histolytica, cryptosporidium, and cyclospora. And all of these can be spread either from the water or from food that's mishandled. Next slide, number 9. Now, there are several ways to try to prevent traveler's diarrhea. There's an old axiom that says, boil it, cook it, peel it, or forget it. The key to all this is that you want to make sure that your hot food is hot, your cold food is cold. You also want to make sure that whenever possible, you maintain proper hand hygiene. And that's either washing your hands with safe water and soap before you eat or using some type of alcohol-based hand sanitizer. You want to stick to safe fluids, and this includes bottled water, juice, beer, soda, hot coffee, and tea. Some people will take Pepto-Bismol 4 times a day to try to prevent this. And prophylactic antibiotics is not typically recommended to try to prevent traveler's diarrhea, although there are some exceptions. If you're going to be in a location for a short amount of time, say a week or maybe 2 weeks, and you've got some things that you absolutely positively have to get done during that period, then it may be worthwhile to take a prophylactic antibiotic so that you don't come down with the diarrhea while you're there. Next slide. Now, the treatment, should you come down with traveler's diarrhea, it includes lots of PO fluids that are safe, as I've already mentioned. You can take Pepto-Bismol, you can take Imodium, you can take Lamotil to try to alleviate some of the symptoms. Next slide. And there's a whole host of antibiotics that you can take to try to treat traveler's diarrhea. And depending upon what the agent is that's causing the diarrhea, they can be very effective. Trimethoprim sulfa, that is Bactrim or Scepter, used to be the mainstay of this, but because there's so much resistance now by ETEC, it's seldom used. And so there are different types of antibiotics that can use. Some of the more popular these days include azithromycin. You just take a 1 gram dose, and that's all you need. Or levofloxacin, just a single 500 milligram dose, and this will take care of it. You can also take cefixime or ciprofloxacin or ofloxacin. What a lot of people will be using for prophylaxis, if they don't want to develop the diarrhea, is take ciprofloxacin 500 milligrams once a day, or azithromycin 250 milligrams once a day, or levofloxacin 250 milligrams once a day. So there's a whole variety of medications that you can try if you want to prevent it. There's also a new drug that was just released in the United States, and I assume that it's going to be released in Canada sometime soon as well. and it's called Rifaximin, Rifaximin. The brand name is Xifaxan, Xifaxan. And this is a unique drug in that it's not absorbed from the GI tract. It's a very small portion. And you take one tablet three times a day for treatment over a three-day period, and it's very effective. And it's indicated it's mainly for ETEC and not for the other types of traveler's diarrhea. Next slide. Now, the next topic we're going to be talking about is a mosquito-borne disease. And the major one here is malaria. It causes almost 500 million cases each year worldwide and up to 3 million deaths. The cause is by Plasmodium protozoan parasite, and it's transmitted by the female Anopheles mosquito. Next slide. The parasite has four different subspecies. The most common is falciparum. It causes up to 60% of malaria cases and up to 95% of the deaths. And it is the main reason that we have chloroquine resistance. Chloroquine is the main, or used to be the mainstay for prophylaxis against Plasmodium, but it is not these days. The second most common type is Plasmodium vivax, and then Plasmodium ovale in West Africa, and then Plasmodium malariae. The pictures that you see there, you can see the falciparum parasite on the top photo, and on the lower photo, you can actually see it within the red blood cells. Next slide. Now, this is an example of the life cycle of the Plasmodium, and it has two main phases, one in mosquitoes and one in humans. And if you look at the left-hand side, you'll see where the parasites are sucked up by the mosquito. Then in the mosquito, you have an oocyte or a cyst develop in the gut wall where you have the immature sporozoites develop. Then the sporozoites go to the salivary glands of the mosquito. It then feeds again on a human. It passes the sporozoites into the bloodstream. They go to the liver. They develop into merozoites. Then they enter the red blood cells, and this is what causes all of the symptoms of malaria. You have breakdown and lysis of the red blood cells, and then it's released, and then it's sucked up again by the mosquitoes. Next slide. This is a map to give you an idea of where malaria is found throughout the world. And you can see it's in Central America, South America, Sub-Saharan Africa, India, the Far East, and Oceania. The chloroquine resistant zones include South America, Africa, India, and the Far East. Next slide. Now, the symptoms of malaria occur 1 to 2 weeks after inoculation for Plasmodium falciparum and a few weeks longer for the other types of Plasmodium. Typically, what develops first is fever and chills, terrible sweats, headache, myalgia, and malaise. Then it can progress, particularly if it goes untreated, to anemia, hepatomegaly, splenomegaly, jaundice, renal failure, coma, and death. Next slide. The diagnosis of malaria is based, if you're in an endemic area, very often they look at the clinical signs and symptoms, and they can tell whether or not you have malaria. From there, they look at thick and thin blood smears, and you can see an example of that on the picture on the left, where you can actually see the parasites within the red blood cells. There are also several antigen test kits on the market these days that can detect antigens to falciparum and vivax, and also one to ovale, that people can carry these in their first aid kits. And if they're in an area where malaria is endemic and they get the symptoms, they can just do a simple whole blood test. It takes about 20 minutes, and they can determine whether or not they've got malaria. Next slide. How do you prevent malaria? Well, first of all, you've got to be aware of whether or not it's present in some place that you're traveling to. This is key. Once you determine that you're going to have problems, potentially problems with malaria, you want to make sure that you've got protective clothing. You want to cover as much skin surface area as possible. And that includes everything from a cap down to having your pants tucked into your shoes. At night, you want to use mosquito netting. For any type of exposed skin, you want to use DEET on board as an insect repellent. And permethrin is an insecticide that you can spray directly onto your clothes or onto your mosquito netting at night to keep the mosquitoes away from you as well. And then the other key factor with malaria is that you take appropriate drug prophylaxis. Next slide. Now, there are various drugs that you can take for drug prophylaxis. They're typically started 1 to 2 weeks prior to your start of travel, and most of them you have to continue for 4 weeks post-travel because malaria, once it first enters the body, can stay in the liver and it won't come out into a stage into the bloodstream for a few weeks. Chloroquine, in areas where the malaria is sensitive to it, is the primary drug that's taken for prophylaxis, and you just take 500 milligrams once a week. An alternative to that is hydroxychloroquine, although most people think that it's not as effective as chloroquine itself. If you are in an area that has chloroquine resistance, then you have to revert to other types of drugs. One of the most popular used to be Larium or Mefloquine, 250 milligrams once a week. The problem with this drug is that many people ended up having some neuropsychiatric problems. While they were on the drug, they would become confused. They would have memory loss. Some of them would actually become acutely psychotic. And back in the mid-90s, it got a lot of bad press. It is a very effective drug, but people must be aware that they may be sensitive to it in that respect. Doxycycline is very effective as a drug prophylaxis. It's 100 milligrams, but you have to take it once a day, and that can be a problem because people will forget to take it. The other problem with doxycycline is that it can make you photosensitive, so you may develop a rash on it in the tropical areas. Next slide. Malarone is another popular drug. The good thing about this drug, even though you have to take it once a day, is you only have to start it 1 week prior to travel, and you only have to continue it for 1 week post-travel. And the reason for this is that it can actually attack the plasmodium in its liver stage. Proguanil is another alternative, and primaquine as well. Some people also use primaquine as a causal agent because, again, that can kill the plasmodium in the early life cycle. Next slide. Malaria treatment. Again, it depends upon whether or not the plasmodium that you're dealing with is chloroquine sensitive or resistant. If it's chloroquine sensitive, you can just use chloroquine. And if you're considering that it's plasmodium vivax or ovale, which can persist a bit longer, you also want to add primaquine to that. If you do have problems with chloroquine resistance, again, you'll have to resort to different drugs, and that includes quinine plus doxycycline or fansidar, and many people will take this along with them so that they can treat themselves. The other option to self-treatment is Malarone, 4 tablets as a single dose, once a day for 3 days. Next slide. SARS. Now, this is a fascinating disease that we've all seen develop over the past couple of years. And not only is this a new infectious disease whose global spread was directly associated with international air travel, but its emergence also affected travel plans for tens of thousands of people worldwide for several months. It was the emerging disease for 2003, and it had its origins in the Guangdong province of southern China. Next slide. The causative agent for SARS is SARS-associated coronavirus. The coronavirus is a family of enveloped RNA viruses common to several species of birds and mammals, including man, that cause a variety of respiratory and enteric diseases. In humans, it causes about 30% of mild upper respiratory disease as well. This particular coronavirus is felt to have jumped from one species to the next, to the human species, and the primary suspect in this is the civet, which is related to the mongoose and is a food source in southern China. Next slide. Now, the way that SARS is spread is through close person-to-person contact, and that includes respiratory droplets, and then the droplets contaminate environmental surfaces. People then touch them, and then they touch their own mucous membranes in the eyes, the nose, or the mouth. It can also be spread directly via aerosol. And the important thing in looking at these types of transmission is how to prevent it. And so in looking at preventing the spread of SARS, is you have to look at respiratory droplet and contact precautions as well. Next slide. SARS infection, there's an incubation period after inoculation of about 2 to 10 days. People typically have a fever of greater than 38 degrees Celsius and a dry cough. From there, it can progress to shortness of breath and chest congestion, and also associated with constitutional symptoms such as chills, rigors, and headache. As it progresses, it may develop pneumonia, and death is usually secondary to acute respiratory distress syndrome and multi-system organ failure. Next slide. The surveillance for SARS became a big issue back in 2003 worldwide at airports and train stations and on cruise lines. There was a period back in 2003 where if you had a fever and a cough and you happened to travel through one of the hotspots where SARS was located, there was no way you were going to be getting on a ship anywhere. And so the surveillance looked at the clinical signs and symptoms and whether or not you were had been in an area where SARS was suspected or confirmed within the previous 10 days, or if you had had a close contact with a suspect or confirmed case of SARS within 10 days. Next slide. The diagnosis involved having positive surveillance criteria, and very quickly, just in a matter of months, they were able to come up with some reliable diagnostic lab tests. The most common types are the reverse transcriptase, polymerase chain reaction, enzyme immunoassay, and you can also do SARS cultures as well. In looking for antibodies, it's important to remember that it may take up to 28 days for the antibodies to develop. Next slide. Treatment. Unfortunately, there hasn't been any standardized treatment for SARS. It's mainly supportive care. People have tried various combinations of steroids and ribavirin and interferon, but there are all conflicting reports over whether or not these are effective at all. The key to preventing the spread, again, is the isolation of the person who has SARS using all three of respiratory droplet and contact precautions. Now, what do you do if you're traveling and should SARS become an issue like it did just last year? Well, one of the things that you want to do is try to stay away from areas that have epidemics going on. That's the most likely thing that you can do to try to prevent you coming down with SARS. If you happen to be in an area where it arises, very important that you maintain proper hand hygiene, washing your hands continuously throughout the day, or using some type of alcohol-based hand sanitizer. The good thing about SARS being a coronavirus is that it typically is very sensitive to low-level disinfectants, and that include the hand sanitizers. And then also during the day, avoid mucous membrane contact, such as your nose, your mouth, and your eyes. And if you're in an area where it is epidemic, also consider carrying along an N95 mask just to protect your respiratory system as well. Next slide. The next topic, we're going from mosquitoes to ticks. I'm going to talk about Lyme borreliosis, or more commonly known as Lyme disease. This is caused by Spirochete Borrelia burgdorferi and is transmitted by Ixodes species ticks. Now, I live in New Hampshire, in New England here, and Lyme disease is endemic here. And here, the primary tick is Ixodes scapularis, or the eastern black-legged tick. Now, out on the west coast, they have the Ixodes specificus tick, or the western black-legged tick. And if you look at the picture there, what you're seeing is the four different phases of the black-legged tick. If you look at the smallest phase on the right, that is the larvae. And what happens is that the adults lay the eggs hatch in the spring, and then they develop into the larval stage. This feeds once, typically on mice or birds, and then it molts into the next phase, which is the nymph phase. And this sort of hibernates during the winter. And in the spring, it comes out again, feeds on a variety of hosts, including humans. And then during the spring, summer, it develops into the adults. And then by the fall, you've got adults, and they can also feed on humans as well. The whole life cycle takes about 2 years for the black-legged ticks. And there are multiple reservoir hosts, white-footed mouse in the east, white-tailed deer out west. You also have the dusky-footed wood rat, But you also have a lot of domesticated animals that are involved in this as well, such as dogs, cats, sheep, cattle, and horses. Next slide. Now, this map just shows you the worldwide distribution of Lyme disease. As you can see, it's mainly in the temperate climate zones in the northern hemisphere. And this is a map, next slide. This is a map of Lyme disease in the United States. And as you can see, over in the East Coast, there's areas where it's high levels of Lyme disease, including New Hampshire, where I'm from. And, of course, as you go north of the border there, it continues up into Canada as well. Next slide. The prevention of Lyme disease, again, is risk awareness. You've got to be aware if Lyme disease is present in an area that you're going to be visiting. You want to try to avoid tick-prone environments. Now, this is difficult to do. They say to stay away from thick brush or tall grasses or heavy concentrations of dry leaves. But in reality, when you're in an area where it's endemic, it's all across the lawns where I live here. They've actually done studies where they, over an acre of lawn, you'll get thousands of these ticks out in the middle of the lawn. So it's very hard to avoid these areas. You try to wear light-colored protective clothing. Again, you want to keep as much of your body covered as possible. You want to keep your trouser legs tucked into your shoes and socks so that they can't get in there. You want to have light-colored clothing so that you can see the ticks a little easier. And remember, these smaller ticks, the larval stage is really only about the size of a period on a piece of newspaper, so they're very hard to see. And the nymphal stage is looks like a little freckle, so they're very hard to see. You have to look very carefully. The other thing that we instruct all parents to do around here is to have a daily body surface exam for ticks. You can either do this yourself or have somebody else do it for you. And it's surprising how often you can find a tick on the small of your back that you may not even feel. The other two things that you want to consider is using an insect repellent that contains DEET and then permethrin on your clothes as well. Next slide, number 33. Now, there are three stages of Lyme disease when somebody becomes infected. After you get a bite of the Ixodes tick, the inoculation requires 1 to 2 days of attachment. So if you just find the tick walking on you, it's nothing to worry about. Or if you know that it's only been there for a short amount of time and it's not engorged, then it's unlikely that it's going to be transmitting Lyme disease to you. After 7 to 14 days of incubation, about 80% of the people will develop erythema migrans or a typical bullseye rash, as you can see in the picture there. Along with this, they're going to develop constitutional symptoms such as fever, headache, muscle aches, joint aches, and fatigue. And the important thing is that only about half of the people who show up with Lyme disease ever recall having a tick on them or removing a tick. So very often, this is the first thing that you're going to see is this bullseye rash. Next slide. Now, stage two of Lyme disease is the early disseminated phase. It takes weeks to months after inoculation. If they're not treated or if they're not treated aggressively enough, and you have two types of manifestations. One is neurologic, where they can develop a facial or Bell's palsy. They can develop an aseptic meningitis or encephalitis. They can develop radiculoneuritis, which is an inflammation of the sensory and motor nerves, so that they can have paresthesias or pain in just different parts of their body. They can have neuropsychiatric disturbances, memory loss, psychotic episodes, and so on. Next slide. They can also have cardiac manifestations, primarily AV block, but they can also develop pericarditis, myocarditis, and cardiomyopathy that can actually lead to heart failure. Next slide. Stage three is a late disseminated phase. It can be months to years after inoculation. And during that time, they develop chronic progressive joint pains and actually can develop a severe arthritis, as you can see in the left leg of this young person in the picture there. Next slide. The diagnosis of Lyme disease, looking at the clinical signs and symptoms, and then there are different types of tests that you can do, enzyme immunoassay, indirect fluorescent antibodies, and those two tests are typically confirmed with the Western immunoblot test. You can also do polymerase chain reaction testing for genomic DNA, but this is not the primary test for Lyme disease currently, but it is available as well. Next slide. So how do you treat Lyme disease, Lyme borreliosis? Well, there was an interesting report in New England Journal of Medicine in 2001 where they looked at prophylaxis for Lyme disease. So if you're in an area where Lyme disease is endemic and you have a suspicious lesion or a suspicious tick bite and you pull it off and they're not really sure of what it is, then you can treat them with a single dose of doxycycline. Very simple to do, and it's effective in preventing Lyme disease from progressing. If you have erythema migraines early on, and so you have several options of either giving doxycycline or amoxicillin or cefuroxime or erythromycin anywhere from 14 to 21 days. There was an article in the Annals of Internal Medicine in 2003 that suggests that even as little as 10 days may be adequate with doxycycline for the treatment of erythema migraines. Next slide. Then if you develop the arthritis symptoms later in the disease, you can treat with doxycycline for an extended period, 30 to 60 days, or amoxicillin, or you can treat them intravenously with ceftriaxone or penicillin. Next slide. Later therapy for central nervous system symptoms, again, ceftriaxone and penicillin intravenously, and for carditis, ceftriaxone or penicillin. If the cardiac involvement is restricted only to AV block, then you may consider treatment with oral antibiotics that include doxycycline and amoxicillin. The key to all this in avoiding the complications of Lyme disease is, again, disease awareness and early treatment. Next slide. Now, we're going to look at some vaccine-preventable disease, but first we're going to have a bit of a geography lesson to give you an idea of where these diseases are around the world. Cholera, it's caused by Vibrio cholera, and the outbreaks occur around the world, and they're often associated with natural and man-made disasters that result in drinking water being contaminated by human waste. Next slide. Hepatitis A is an enteric disease that we're all familiar with. As you can see from the map here, it's in most places around the world that you have a moderate to high risk of developing this. Anybody that is going on regular international travel should have the hepatitis vaccine. This is a disease that is almost 100% preventable if somebody gets the vaccine ahead of time. Next slide. Hepatitis B, a bloodborne pathogen, we're all familiar with this in the hospital and medical industry. This is particularly important for healthcare workers, missionaries, humanitarian aid workers, or people who plan on staying in these areas where it's high risk for an extended period of time. It's also important for people who are going to be expats in these particular countries that to make sure that they have the hepatitis B vaccine. Next slide. Hepatitis C, there's no vaccine yet, but I just wanted to bring this to your attention. As you can see, there are risks for this particular disease all over the world. Again, it's a bloodborne pathogen. It's a leading indication for liver transplant in the United States and could be spread through various body fluids. It's also a sexually transmitted disease. It can be spread through IV drug use or tainted blood supply. And so if you're going to be staying for extended periods of time, or if you're a healthcare worker or a missionary in the areas of the world where this is particularly troublesome, then you may want to consider bringing your own needles, syringes, parenteral medications, and if you're going to be sexually active, make sure you've got condoms with you as well. Next slide. Japanese encephalitis, this is a disease, the viral illness carried by the Culex mosquito, reservoirs in pigs and birds. It's a seasonal disease, particularly in the spring, summer, and early fall, and it's mainly in the rural areas. So if you're going to be going to the area of the world where this is prevalent and you're going to be staying more in the rural areas, this is something that you may want to consider. Next slide. Polio, this is something that we all take for granted. It's not a problem anymore. But as you can see from the map, there are still pockets throughout the world where polio is still present. the World Health Organization hopes that we're going to see the last of polio within the next few years. But again, there are some risks, but mainly for, again, the healthcare workers, missionaries, and people who are planning long stays in these areas. Next slide. Rabies. This is one of those diseases that we don't think much about here in North America. The number of cases that we see in Canada and the United States each year is perhaps one or two. Very often they're imported from somebody who has been traveling elsewhere. But it's important to know that this is a significant health problem in different parts of the world. In India, each year, 30,000 people die from rabies. That makes up 80% of the world's total deaths from rabies. And in India, 95% of the rabies is spread by domestic and feral dogs over there. So if you're going to an area, typically out in the bush or in an area such as India, where you're going to be spending more than a couple of weeks, it may be worthwhile to consider getting a rabies vaccine. Next slide. Tuberculosis. And I've sort of put a question mark here over whether or not it's a vaccine-preventable disease. Down here in the States, they typically don't recommend getting a vaccine, the BCG vaccine, which is an attenuated strain of Mycobacterium bovis, on a regular basis. In other parts of the world, various countries, kids are usually given the vaccine as a teenager, and it's debatable how effective it is. However, if you look at the reports out there, it may cut down on the risk of tuberculosis by 50%, and that protection can last for up to 50 or 60 years. There is a vaccine available in the United States if you're going to an area where TB is endemic and you're worried about getting it. You can get the BCG. You just have to be aware that it may be effective, may not be effective. Typically what we do in the States is that we use PPD testing. If you're going to go in an area where it's endemic, you get tested before you go, make sure it's clear, and then you get tested after you come back as well. If it turns positive, then you're treated with INH and rifampin, depending upon where in the world you contracted the TB. Next slide. Yellow fever. This is another viral disease carried by the Aedes aegypti mosquitoes. As you can see, it's in South America and Central Africa. It causes an influenza-like illness along with hepatitis and a hemorrhagic fever. The important thing about the yellow fever vaccine and the fact that it can not only prevent yellow fever, but no countries require you to have it to get into the country. It's just that some countries require you to have the vaccine if you go to one country where it's epidemic or endemic, and then you try to go into another country. That second country may be the one that requires you to have the vaccine on board because they don't want to have the yellow fever being transferred to their country. Next slide. So there's a whole list of vaccines out there that you can get, and how do you decide which one you get? Well, typically what we do is we categorize the vaccines into three different groups. One is the routine immunizations. And this is diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, MMR, polio, influenza. You know, last year, we were very lucky last year. They were worried about how severe the influenza was going to be. Caused several deaths in children in the United States and Canada last year. It is important when you're traveling internationally that you make sure that your influenza vaccine is up to date. And keep in mind that the seasonality of influenza sort of goes out the window if you're doing a lot of international travel, particularly if you're going between the Northern Hemisphere and the Southern Hemisphere, because the flu seasons are opposite one another. So we get it here in our winter, and they get it there in their winter. Pneumococcal vaccine for people who are at risk and those over the age of 50. Influenza, H influenza B, you know, this is essentially we don't see kids anymore with H flu, earaches anymore, and kids are getting varicella. In the United States, children, by the time they're 18 months of age, end up getting 20 doses of vaccines out there. But if you're an adult and you're going to do a lot of international travel, check with your healthcare provider and make sure that all of your common immunizations are up to date. Next slide. The next class of vaccines are those that are recommended depending upon what destination that you're going to. I mentioned hepatitis A and B. You can get a combination vaccine for this called Twinrix now. Even in the United States, it only costs about $200 for the whole series. I think that anybody who is going to be doing international travel on a regular basis, and particularly healthcare providers, should have hepatitis A and B vaccines. If for some reason you don't have it on board right away, you may want to take a dose of immune globulin until your hepatitis A vaccine kicks in. Meningococcus, this is something that arises when you have a lot of people in limited space. You see this in college dorms. You see it in military barracks. You see it people going to Mecca, to the Hajj each year. And again, it depends upon where you're going and where what the risk is. This is a single dose. You get a booster after 3 to 5 years. Japanese encephalitis, again, it's a rural disease for the most part. You get injections at 0, 7, and 30 days prior to departure. Plague, again, this is something that it's a very specific disease, usually with researchers who are out in the bush. However, back in 2002, they had a case of bubonic and septicemic plague in New York City that was imported by an unfortunate person from New Mexico. The plague vaccine, you can get it at 0, 1, and 10 months. Rabies, I've already mentioned. If you go into an area where it's endemic, high risk, you can get a pre-exposure prophylaxis, and that's 3 doses at day 0, 7, and 3 weeks or so. Tick-borne encephalitis, again, mainly for researchers or people who are out there on providing relief work. Tuberculosis, we've talked about BCG. And typhoid fever, you have the options of an oral vaccine or a single injection. There's also a combination hepatitis A and typhoid vaccine as well. Next slide. Yellow fever, single dose, subcutaneous, lasts for about 10 years. And cholera, you can have either a single SC or IM dose, and then you have another dose a week later and booster in 6 months. Well, you can take one oral dose as well. There's a new product out there called Dukoral. It's a cholera and ETEC vaccine. You take a PO at day one and then about a week later and a booster in 6 months, and it protects you both against cholera and ETEC. Next slide. So many of these travel-related infectious diseases can be prevented with the proper travel preparation. And what you've got to do, again, is to look at your destination, see what's there, see what type of diseases are there, and what you have to be concerned about. Again, you want to make sure that your health status is going to be adequate to make the trip and even withstand some of these potential diseases should you come in contact with them. Always make sure that you take the appropriate disease prophylaxis, whether that be drugs or vaccines, prior to your leaving on the trip. Another thing that I always encourage people to do is look at what your insurance coverage is at home. You know, in the States, we have a lot of elderly people who are traveling, and many don't realize that the Medicare does not cover them outside of the United States. So I always recommend that people check with their health insurer and ask them two questions. One, if I get ill or injured in another country, will my expenses be covered for medical treatment? And the other question is, if I get really seriously ill or injured, will you pay to get me back home? And if the answer to either one of those is no, then people should consider taking out some type of additional travel medical insurance as well. And the other thing I always recommend people to do is to take along a travel medical kit. And in your handout, I gave you an example of a kit that you can put together on your own. And you add to this any prescription drugs that you may have or any prophylactic drugs that you may take along with you, depending upon what your destination is going to be. Next slide. Now, even though you've done your homework and you've taken all your prophylactic medications and you've washed your hands and you've taken your vaccinations and you make it back home, you're not out of the woods yet. Even up to 3 or 4 weeks after you get home, if you develop any atypical symptoms or unexplained symptoms, respiratory symptoms, GI symptoms, or constitutional symptoms, always consider the possibility that you may have picked up something in a destination that you would travel to. So always keep that in mind when you're going to visit your healthcare provider and mention that you had traveled a few weeks before that and let them know where you were at that time. Next slide. Now, this has all been just a hint of what travel medicine infectious disease entails. And there are a lot of resources available. Two of my favorites are the Health Information for International Travel Guide by the CDC and the International Travel and Health Guide by World Health Organization. These are both available on their respective websites. They're updated constantly. And these are probably two of the most timely resources you can use. If you want to have a textbook for travel medicine and health, I can recommend the book by DuPont and Stefan. They also have a smaller handbook that goes along with this, the Travel and Tropical Medicine Manual by Elaine Zhang and Russell McMullen. This is a very well-written handbook that you can take along with you. It gives you lots of information about travel medicine as a whole. And if you want to have a big volume on wilderness medicine, which also entails much of what's out there on travel medicine, is the Wilderness Medicine by Paul Auerbach. This is a big book. It's not something you're going to carry along with you. It's about 2,000 pages, but it works well in your hospital or your own personal library. Next slide. Certainly, there are a lot of resources on the Internet. Again, two of my favorites are the Centers for Disease Control and Health Canada and the World Health Organization. There's also lots of information at the website for the International Society of Travel Medicine. Next slide. In closing, I'd just like to quote the International Society for Travel Medicine, "Travel widely, but travel wisely." It encourages all of you to get out there and explore the world, but to be aware of the potential hazards of travel and to make plans before you leave home in order to respond to these hazards en route. Many travel-related infectious diseases can be avoided with awareness of their prevalence in a particular destination. They can be prevented with vaccines and other measures such as insect repellents, prophylactic medications, and of course adherence to safe food and good hygiene protocols. And then they can be treated in a timely fashion. All this will help to ensure a healthy journey and a safe trip back home. Thank you all for your participation today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Bob, for that wealth of information. There's obviously a lot more to be said on the topic that can be given in 1 hour, so we'll have to have you back again in 2005, perhaps. I'd like to say, too, that Weber Training does not endorse or promote any product or company, and that mention of brand names should not be considered as an endorsement. Bob, later this year in November, you are organizing a conference, as you did 2 years ago. Can you talk a little bit about the sales conference?
Well, yes. I'm very excited about this follow-up to our conference in 2002. It's called Sales 2, and it stands for Shipboard Assessment, Intervention, and Life Support for Cruise Ship Medicine. This is a unique conference in the way that it's presented because rather than getting handouts or a notebook, the entire program is distributed on a Sony Clié handheld computer. And we're going to be presenting topics that address issues of critical care, infectious disease, medical evacuations, particularly dealing with cruise ship travel, but it also addresses a lot of general medical issues as well. We're approved for 18 hours of continuing medical education. And for those of you who are not using a handheld computer, that is a Palm Pilot or the like, I guarantee that by the end of the week, you'll all be very adept at using your handheld computer. In addition to have the handouts directly on the Sony Clié, we also preload it with a variety of medical programs that are available for the Palm operating system. And so one of my functions during the week is to teach everybody not only how to use the handheld computer, but how to use all these different programs out there as well. So I welcome all of you to look at my website is listed on the last slide of the handout there. You can go to the website and see what we're offering for the conference, and you're all welcome to attend as well. And Paul will be there.
Thank you, Bob. In fact, I was there in 2002 as well, and it was an exceptional conference, and there were a great many Canadians there, a lot of them physicians who I think were considering taking their families on a cruise for free and as working as a cruise ship physician at the time, and it was an awfully fun conference. Thank you very much.
I just wanted to know if you could comment on the use of yogurt pills or acidophilus pills for the prevention of traveler's diarrhea.
Well, there's a group of a large group of people that find these very effective. I think if you look at the literature, it's sort of split over whether or not they're effective or if it's necessary to do it. I think that what most people do now is that they may take that, but they always have medication, the antibiotics with them, just in case they fail. But it is an option to use.
Is there any use at this point in time or availability of the Lyme disease vaccine in the States now?
No, that vaccine was taken off the market in 2002, I believe. There were a few reasons. One, it wasn't being utilized enough. And two, there was some controversy over whether or not people were getting antibody responses to it and actually causing symptoms that were similar to Lyme disease, and whether or not they were actually developing Lyme disease secondary to the vaccine. But it's no longer available in the States.
Is there any word on a replacement vaccine?
I don't think so. I think there was too much money spent in getting the vaccine to market. And again, it didn't sell as well as they could, and as well as they thought it would. And then they started to have reports of side effects from it. So I don't think there's any in the planning, or at least will be available anytime soon.
Is the testing for Lyme any more reliable than it used to be?
That is always a very big problem. They'll usually have the primary test, and then they do a follow-up for the Western blot test with an immunoblot test. And so it's a sequential testing. You know, very often it may be negative early on. You just have to repeat the test. And some people actually are having negative tests. They don't have the necessary responses that they typically would. So there has to be a high index of suspicion, knowing what area, whether it's endemic in the area where they travel to, if there was a history of the bullseye rash, whether or not they pulled a tick off. And so a lot of these have to go into deciding whether or not to treat these people as full-blown Lyme disease.
So thanks again to everyone who's listening today. And again, thank you, Dr. Wheeler. Until the next time we meet, stay safe. Goodbye.